You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Today on the Christmas edition of the Useless Information Retrocast, you'll hear stories about a reindeer who wanted more than a bite of a little boy's lollipop. And then there's the story of a lawsuit of the world's largest Christmas stocking and a jokester who filled a couple's bathtub with flavored gelatin as a holiday greeting. Well, all those stories, plus the question of the day, today's retro sponsor, and more, they are coming up next on today's Useless Information Retrocast. I am Steve Silverman, and this is the Useless Information Podcast.
Useless Information.
Hi, everyone. Happy holidays. My wife, Mary Jane's back with us.
Hi, everyone.
And today we have for you a totally Christmas episode. It's not that I didn't look for stories on Hanukkah and other things, but really I didn't find anything that was good other than Christmas. I have a whole folder, and basically it's just filled with Christmas stories. And most of them are just short little tidbits, and we're going to talk about some of those today. But before we get going, I just wanted to mention that a couple weeks ago I was contacted by a guy. Now, if you recall, about 3 years ago, I did a story called Christmas Time in Santaheim, and it's about this guy, Harry Heim, who made a lot of money after World War II producing Christmas ornaments, and he used his profits to buy an old manufacturing facility outside of Washington, D.C. in Maryland, in Savage, Maryland, and he wanted to create the world's largest Christmas village, and it was a financial disaster. But anyway, I got an email from his sister's grandson, and he said his family had never ever heard this story before. And basically his sister, I guess I've been doing some ancestry type stuff, came across my article and just contacted me. Now, I know, Mary Jane, you loved that story.
I did. It's I don't know, it's very sweet. You especially the quotes from the people. Mm-hmm. People spoke differently in that time period, and the kids were so wholesome. I mean, I remember one in particular who asked for presents for his mother so that could help her with her housework.
Yeah.
Very sweet.
When I stumbled across it, I don't know where I found that story. I never know where I find these things because right. I work on them over time. But I knew when I put it together, I had something good. And that's one of my favorite Christmas stories. If you've never heard it, definitely go back and listen to it. It's called Christmas Time in Santaheim. And I would have put it out in December of, I think it was 2018.
Yep.
So anyway, so let's dive into today's stories.
Okay.
So in our house, we have a traditional Christmas tree, albeit a fake one.
Yes, it's a bit of a Charlie Brown Christmas tree, so
yeah,
to speak.
That's a good way to describe it. Yeah. Every year when we take it out of the box, we still have the original box. When we take it out, we have to spend like about 45 minutes trying to fill in all the...
Unbending it, too. Yeah. It's all scrunched up.
Yeah, yes. But once you put the ornaments on, it looks pretty good. Of course, it's got the obligatory lights, ornaments, and some tinsel. And as you said, it's not one of the greatest looking trees, but luckily we live way up on a hill. And as you drive up the road by our house... We have it facing down towards that. And at night, it actually looks quite nice.
Yeah, you can see it through the window. And
yeah, it looks a lot better from the distance than it does close up.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so anyway, well, back in 1900, students in the University of Pennsylvania's biology department in Philadelphia, they opted to decorate their tree with some more unusual decorations. So forget the garland. Instead, they used long strings of vertebrae that came from various animals. So you can imagine this, right? Strings of basically spines.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Anyway, from the tree's branches, they hung all kinds of bugs and worms, and then various types of fish were placed near the worms, and that was suggestive of the natural desire of fish to eat the worms. Now, I assume, and you probably agree on this, these were preserved specimens. These weren't like they just went out and got, they probably just had all these things preserved around the department.
Right.
Other ornaments included an assortment of preserved reptiles plus birds' nests that were full of eggs, and they placed preserved mother's birds. They positioned them so they appeared to be providing protection for their young. Stuffed monkeys were the sole representative of the mammals. Surprised they didn't have preserved humans.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, just kidding there. Anyway, and forget the gifts under the tree. The students placed big jars that were filled with preserved cats, pigs, and chickens around the base of the tree. Then they put piles of bones, skulls, and teeth, and that added a bit of a biting edge to the display, if you get my bad pun there.
Yes, I got that joke, yes.
Anyway, and let's not forget the festive colors of green and blue molds and slime that accentuated the cheese, old boots, and rotten logs that were added to this preserved menagerie. Now, the article, which appeared in the Boston Globe, claimed that this was an old custom and that the lively tree was a gift to the professors. Now, I could find nothing else in the newspapers about this, that it was a tradition, or if they even do it today, I'd be very surprised. So after I finished reading this, the one thing that stood out to me was the stuffed monkeys. Now, when I first started writing, it's like, oh, stuffed monkeys, you know, a stuffed toy. But I'm thinking this is a biology department. It was probably, you know, taxidermists involved there, that they were probably.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that would have been keeping with the whole decoration.
Yeah. Right? It kind of reminds me, this is going back, let's see, I went to University of Rochester for my master's degree probably about 35 years ago in the mid-80s. And in the geology department, you got to imagine that geology is rocks. There's nothing alive.
Right.
And on the shelf in one of the labs was a mummified cat. And it was like a mascot. It was there. I don't know how. It had to be there for decades, I'm sure. And I have no idea where this cat came from. It just sat there on a shelf. And every once in a while, one of the other students would grab it. And it just kind of is a mascot.
Did it have a name?
It must have, but I just don't remember it anymore. Yeah. I remember the first time someone said, oh, there's our mummified cat up on the shelf, and whatever name it may have had. It just kind of struck me as bizarre, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on. You can do the next story.
Okay. On December 23rd, 1954, Dorothy Ferris of 42 Lakewood Avenue in Roosevelt, Long Island, took her 2-year-old son, Richard, to nearby West Hempstead to see a Christmas display that featured 8 live reindeer. Apparently, Rudolph got the day off.
Now, I'm doing my math there when I wrote this. I assume it was 8 reindeer plus Rudolph. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Yeah.
As the two stood behind the protective fence, Richie took the lollipop that he had been sucking on and poked it through the fence and shoved it under the nose of one of the reindeer. After sniffing the treat, the curious animal decided to give it a lick. It must have tasted great, since the next thing that happened was that the reindeer grabbed the entire lollipop, stick and all. And when I say all, I mean all. That included trying to remove the end of Richie's finger. Richie pulled his hand back as blood began to gush out of his finger. He screamed at the top of his lungs as jingle bells played over the public address system. Mom wrapped Richie's finger in a handkerchief, put him in the car, and then raced home. Dr. Samuel Postnock came and cauterized the wound and then, as required by law, contacted Dr. Earl Brown, who was the Nassau County Health Commissioner at the time. Brown was informed by zoologists in Manhattan that reindeer have a high incidence of rabies, so he ordered that the entire herd be quarantined until December 29th, 5 days after they had originally been scheduled to depart. Which left police with one big mystery to solve. Who was the guilty party in trying to bite off Richie Ferris's finger? Was it Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, or Blitzen? Or was it all a setup by one of the reindeer who never received the fame and glory of being able to pull Santa's sleigh?
I thought that was a really cute story.
Yeah, it was very cute.
Yeah, now, one thing I should point out is that the story originally appeared in the New York Daily News. It was actually quite a lengthy story, complete with photo and all. Not of the finger, but just, you know, of Richie, you know.
Yeah.
And the headline at the top, the title, said that it was his pinky. Then when you read the story, it said it was his index finger. Yeah. And then if you read the articles that were syndicated in newspapers across the country, they just said finger. So
they just wanted to play it safe.
Right.
My guess is the index finger just by holding a lollipop.
Yeah, I would think the same thing.
Personally.
Now, the other thing that stood out in this article is that they said the blood was gushing. They made it out to be.
Yes. I think they're being dramatic there, right?
Right. Because if the blood was really gushing out, they would have called for an ambulance. Mom wouldn't just wrap it in a handkerchief and then, you know, take him home, wait for a doctor to come by.
They're adding some drama.
Yeah. It is a cute story, though.
Yeah. And you said it was a big story, right? It was in many newspapers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a big story in the New York Daily News. And then a section of a few paragraphs of that was carried in newspapers across the country.
Yeah. Cute.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So the Guinness Book of World Records claims that the world's largest Christmas stocking was created in Carrara, Italy on January 5th of 2011. It measured 168 feet, 5 and 21 32nd inches, which is 51.35 meters long, and it was 70 feet, 11 and 9 16 inches, or 21.63 meters heel to toe. Now, it was created to raise money for the elderly, and since a stocking was required to be filled with presents, they simply filled it with balloons that contained sweets. But I think Guinness may have had it wrong. That's because I came across a series of articles that appeared in newspapers in December of 1965. Basically, WDGY, a Minneapolis, Minnesota radio station, they held a contest to fill the largest stocking that they received with prizes. Of course, one needs to be careful of what one wishes for. That's because three college students from St. Paul, that's Phil Cunian, Ron Mondo, and John Hinson, they submitted a stocking that measured 840 feet, or 256 meters, in length. The three invested $150, which is $1,250 today. They invested $150 into the project and spent an estimated 300 hours sewing the fabric together. The first problem that the radio station had was finding a simple way to measure the stocking. Program director Scott Burton came up with the ingenious idea of having a helicopter lift the stocking up and place it beside the station's radio tower, which was, of course, of known height. Next, they needed a way to fill such a large stocking without, of course, breaking the bank. And like the supposed record holders in Italy, they opted to fill the stocking with balloons. But instead of placing candy inside of each balloon, the station placed a $1 bill inside of each. That would guarantee the winners at least $500 in total. That's $4,170 today. Yet that wasn't the end of the story. 10 students from McAllister College won the second prize, which was, quote, a cheap transistor radio of foreign make, a coupon for 10 hamburgers, 6 promotional phonograph records, a carton of soft drinks, and 5 coupons for 2 quarts of Beep for Breakfast, which was a once-marketed vitamin-enriched breakfast drink. Yet the McAllister students insisted that they should have won the contest because their stocking had a much larger volume than the one that was declared the winner. They claimed that their stocking could hold 7,500 of the dollar-filled balloons. Their argument was that there's a big difference between the largest, which the contest specified, and the longest, of course, which the winning stocking was, even though the longest one was much smaller in volume. So what did they do? They hired a lawyer and sued the radio station. They requested the $7,500 that all those balloons were held in cash, plus an additional $5,000 for the embarrassment that they suffered in their loss. I was unable to find anything further on their lawsuit or how it was settled, but if I had to give a guess, I'd say that the students and the radio station came to some sort of financial agreement, and if anybody out there knows anything about it, let me know. And that leaves me with one big question. Was the stocking in Carrara, Italy really the largest, you know, as Guinness claims? Now, you just heard the evidence, and I'll leave that for you to decide. So, Mary Jane, did you hang stockings up when you were a kid?
Yes, we did. My mother sewed all our names on them. They were red felt stockings, and we put them on the fireplace.
And were they filled with coal?
No, they were filled with candy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And dentist was very happy about that one, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. It's great for business.
Yeah. I grew up in the middle of nowhere, but there was this little store called The Trading Post in Rock Hill, New York. It's still in business today.
Wow.
And my parents would go shopping there, and you know, to get food and groceries, you know, groceries, and they also had a hardware store attached to it. Yeah. But when you'd go to the checkout, over all the carts, all the shopping carts, was this, every year they'd have this giant, giant stocking filled with all kinds of toys and gifts, and they had a contest to see, you know, whoever won the contest would get this giant stocking, and I wanted to win every single year.
What was the contest exactly?
I don't know. I think you just put your name and address and phone number
like
into
a raffle. Almost.
A raffle, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. And of course, never won never the thing. Won. I still want all those gifts in that stocking.
Yeah.
So what'd you think about the story?
I was a little surprised at how seriously college students took this contest. You know, I mean, especially to go so far as hiring a lawyer to figure out who really won. And
And what amazed me, this is right at Christmas time. You know, they're doing this
Around finals.
Yeah. And they're spending 300 hours making this giant stocking.
Sewing a stocking.
Now, there is a fuzzy picture. You know, it's kind of one of those microfilm pictures in the newspaper archives of it. Mm. And they may call it a stocking, but really it's just a long
piece of material sewn
together. Basically. And I think they just sewed up the edges and there's their stocking. Maybe they must have put a little foot at the end. Yeah. But yeah, it didn't look like what you think your traditional Christmas stocking would look like.
So maybe the other team, the McAllister team, maybe they had a good argument there.
Yeah, I mean, it did say largest, which, you know, can be interpreted.
Longest, as they were saying.
Exactly.
And strangest.
So why don't we take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, but when we return, we'll hear some more Christmas stories.
Okay, sounds good.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back. So Mary Jane, here's a question for you. You ready?
Right, sure.
In what year was the first Christmas film made?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that's almost impossible to get an exact date, so just try and get the right
and
decade.
And this includes even silent film, possibly?
Oh, it's definitely silent film.
Okay.
And it's very short. It's under 2 minutes, but it involves Santa Claus and the chimney and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And stockings.
All right.
So you just got to get the correct decade, okay?
Oh, I can win with the correct decade.
Correct decade.
Oh, that's quite generous of you.
Yes. So anyway, I'll let you think about that for a bit, and we'll discuss the answer at the end of the podcast.
Okay.
So for today's retro sponsor, I've chosen Dole Pineapples or Dole Pineapple Juice. You ready for that?
Yes, sure.
Okay, so let's take a listen.
Friends, I know two people who are going to be awfully busy the next few days. That's my wife and my grocer. It's the same in your neighborhood, too, I'll bet. Women rushing around buying all sorts of good things to eat, and grocers rushing around filling extra big orders. Those busy grocers are laying in extra big supplies of Dole pineapple juice, too. They know from experience that folks enjoy lots of that golden cherry from Hawaii at Christmas time. Dole pineapple juice will taste mighty fine first thing Christmas morning, just before the family gathers around the tree to see what old Santa left. Later on in the day, too, when the family can hardly wait for Christmas dinner, keep them happy with Dole pineapple juice. Everybody likes its keen flavor, and when the dinner comes on, they'll all be ready for it. Maybe you're planning a sort of buffet supper or informal gathering for Christmas Eve or Christmas night. And if you are, why not include pineapple juice when you plan your menu? It's the pleasantest beverage I can think of and makes everything else taste better. I'm sure you'll be glad you laid in a big supply of that delicious Dole pineapple juice for the holidays.
That commercial for Dole pineapple juice is from the December 20th, 1939 Christmas episode of The Al Pierce Show. Now, the show was a comedy, and one of the best parts of the show was when Al played the part of a door-to-door salesman named Elmer Blurt. Now, Elmer was incredibly shy, and after he knocked on every door, he would mumble, "I hope there's nobody home. I hope, I hope, I hope." Of course, someone almost always answered the door, and that's where the real comedy would begin. As for Dole Pineapple, and I have to say, I love fresh pineapple, the company was founded as the Hawaiian Pineapple Company in 1901 by James Dole. He was born on September 27, 1877 in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and he went on to receive a bachelor's degree in agriculture from the Bussey Institute at Harvard. At the age of 22, he packed up everything and moved to Hawaii. Now, after I mentioned that his cousin, once removed, Sanford B. Dole, was the president of the Republic of Hawaii at the time, that move makes a lot more sense. Upon arrival, James Dole purchased a 64-acre farm on the island of Oahu, and he experimented with various crops, ultimately choosing to focus on pineapples. Without going into great detail as to how Dole built up his empire, I mean, that could fill an entire book, I'll briefly tell you that his use of technology allowed his company to process pineapples faster than his competitors, and his decision to set up a cannery in Hawaii that allowed for pineapples to be shipped all the way to the East Coast markets of the United States. Plus, he ran a successful nationwide consumer ad campaign, and that all set the foundation for his company to grow and eventually dominate the pineapple industry. His company was eventually acquired by Castle and Cook, which was one of the big five sugarcane producers in Hawaii, and then through various acquisitions and business moves, Dole grew into the mega fruit and veggie powerhouse that it is today. Now, I do have two other commercials from the same show that I'll play later on in the podcast. But I have to say, I really have a dislike for canned pineapple of any form. There's just, I don't know what it is. I mean, supposedly it's just pineapple plus the juice and whatever, but the taste is so different.
It's not as fresh. It's definitely not as good.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We have pineapple typically, you know, at least one a week. I mean, it's pretty easy to, you know, buy a pineapple and just cut
today,
it up.
Today, it's very common. You find them in all the supermarkets.
Yeah. Now, you wanted to quickly mention about growing a pineapple.
Well, you gave me a pineapple plant, being all excited that we would one day have pineapples. But when you gave it to me, I'm like, we live in New York State, Steve. And it's grown a little bit, but there's no way I don't know if it's ever going to produce a pineapple.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention it's a miniature pineapple, and it was designed to grow indoors.
Right.
But we don't get a lot of light indoors here, particularly in the wintertime.
No, not in the winter. So.
And even a typical pineapple, I think, takes 18 to 24 months to reach, you know, to get just one fruit off of it.
An
interesting little side note is that when you look at a pineapple, it looks like one solid flower produced that, but each one of those, I don't know what you would call them, those little shapes on there, is a separate flower. And as it grows, they fuse into one giant fruit, which is what we purchase.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So let's move on.
Okay.
So now it's time for a segment I call Footnotes History. These are short little stories that really there's no further research to do. So we're just going to read them word for word as they appeared in the newspapers years ago. This one's titled Santa Claus Has Trouble Getting Down This Chimney. This is from December 29th, 1937, San Antonio, Texas. And this is an Associated Press story. It's happened. The accident children always fear that Santa Claus may get stuck in a chimney. It happened before their very eyes here last night. Santa started down a specially built chimney at a Salvation Army home party and became wedged in the walls. He could budge neither up nor down. Frantic attendants went to his aid and finally pulled him down. 100 childish faces lined with dismay broke into smiles. A very nonchalant Santa went about the business of distributing his gifts. I should say I come across these kind of stories all the time about Santa getting stuck in chimneys. I have a whole bunch of them.
Really?
I don't know if it's an annual thing, but it's, you know, if you read enough old newspapers, that story seems to repeat itself with time.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Of course, Santa could never get down our chimney. He's got to find a different way into the house. Although he's got his magical powers, so maybe he'll figure out a way.
Mm. This is from December 2nd, 1948, and it's entitled Early Greeting Might Be Said in Bad Taste, from Pueblo, Colorado. Mr. and Mrs. Jack Halstead never eat gelatin for dessert. This worried them considerably yesterday when they returned home from a Denver trip to find that some prankster had mixed approximately 30 gallons of cherry-flavored gelatin in the bathtub. The glassy red stuff was inscribed in whipped cream with the premature greeting, Merry Christmas.
I thought that was a really cute little story.
Yeah.
It left me with a whole bunch of questions. I mean, first of all, it takes a while for gelatin to solidify.
Exactly. I was wondering too. I mean, do you have to refrigerate it? Maybe.
Well, not certainly not in your bathtub.
No, you can't.
So the question is, they must have been gone for quite a while for that to happen. The other thing that popped in my head is, how did they know it was cherry? I mean, would you eat out of your bathtub to find out what flavor it is?
No, I don't know. And they don't like it. But anyway, yeah. They must have. I don't know.
Yeah,
Someone must have.
And then also, how did they know it was 30 gallons? I mean, first of all, it's a pretty small. I mean, a tub holds 80 gallons. And I should say, for those of you overseas, 30 gallons is about 120 liters.
Yeah.
That's not enough to immerse your body. And so how did they, you know...
I have no idea.
But it is a cute story. I mean, there was no follow-up. I couldn't find anything after about this. It'd be right. Curious if it was, you know, who the prankster. They probably found out eventually who the prankster was, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Because probably someone had a key to the place. Yeah,
a friend. Neighbor.
Maybe an adult child or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Now, before we go on with more stories, I said I'd play another one of those Dole pineapple commercials.
All right.
So let's take a listen.
Okay.
You know, Al, this year, a holiday grocery list, they're going to include something they've never had before.
Well, what's that, Gary?
Those new Dole pineapple gems.
Say, by golly, now that you mention it, that is right. This is their first year. Well, we've sure got gems on our grocery list at home.
And so have lots of people all over the country. Every day, more people are discovering Dole pineapple gems. And everyone who tastes this new and unusual cut of pineapple is enthusiastic about it. You know, gems, spelled G-E-M-S, are different. The ripe fruit is cut across the grain into tender, juicy, spoon-sized cubes. Cutting the fruit across the grain releases more of that marvelous pineapple goodness. Why not let the whole family enjoy gems tomorrow? Or their great treat by themselves, and just as they come from the can. And gems are greatest in salads and fruit cups and desserts. They're easy to serve because they're spoon-sized and cube-shaped. Remember the name... Dole Pineapple Gem, G-E-M-S.
Well, a little bit of distortion there in the audio right near the end.
Towards the end, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, these come off old transcription discs, these giant kind of records from, it's actually kind of amazing that so many are still around. Yeah,
yeah.
People started collecting them because they generally just dispose of them once the show was over.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of pineapple gems?
Never.
That's
what I was thinking.
They're always diced or cubed pineapple to me. Again, not one of my favorites. I still prefer a fresh pineapple. Anyway, let's get back to the stories.
Okay.
This story is from December 26, 1949, and is entitled Oddest Gift, Ontario Boy Given Snake by Museum, Santa Barbara, California. Probably one of the oddest Christmas presents today went to the 10-year-old son of Dr. and Mrs. A. Williams of Ontario. It was a king snake, the gift of the Museum of Natural History here. The family drove here from Ontario yesterday to buy the snake, but was informed that the museum had no such pets for sale. However, on learning how unhappy the boy would be, and that his parents had driven 125 miles, that's 200 kilometers, to find such a present, Director Arthur Cogshall of the museum made them a gift of the snake. He shoved it into a sugar bag and the family drove off anticipating a happy Christmas. So did you ever want a snake for Christmas?
No, never.
Yeah, me either.
Absolutely never.
Yeah. As you know, my parents owned a pet shop for 25 years and they did sell snakes. And there were people, now they always kept them under lock and key. They were in a glass. They were in tanks with screen covers on them. And then the cabinet always had a lock and key on it. You know, the glass doors were locked up.
I think I know this is going, but well, go right ahead.
Yeah, and there were still people, and they're always in the back of the store on purpose because people wouldn't walk into the store knowing there were snakes there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean,
they were that afraid.
It was a pretty big store, but, you know, even knowing they were under lock and key, some people couldn't overcome the fear.
A phobia, almost.
But anyway, you know, occasionally one would get loose. And I remember, you know, one year... my mom had mentioned to me that one had gotten loose a couple of months earlier, but they couldn't find it. And there's really not a lot of places to hide in the store, you know. In retail stores, the ceilings are very high, much higher than you'd find in a typical home. And in their storage room, the shelves went all the way to the ceiling. And they asked me to get a box off the shelf. And I think it was like ant bait or something like that. It was a poison. It wasn't sure. anything that was good for anything.
Right.
And you know how they always, how on the top step of every ladder says, do not step here? Because obviously,
because you
could fall over.
Yeah, lose your balance.
Well, of course, guess where I'm standing?
Oh my goodness.
And all of a sudden, I pull this little white box. It was a tiny little white box. I pull it off the shelf. And I look in, and there's a snake, and I almost went over.
Wow! Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grabbed onto the shelving. It was the wire type shelving, so I just grabbed on and didn't go anywhere. But I was like, "Holy cow!" You know, not only has it gone months without eating, which snakes can easily do, and without water, but there it is, coiled up in a box of basically, you know, poison. I mean, everything was wrapped, but the fact that it survived was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I did know that they can live for a very long time without food or anything.
Yeah, so it's just one of those very memorable stories of having a pet shop in the family.
Yeah. So this is from December 17th, 1953, and it's entitled Absent-Minded Santa Claus from Charlotte, North Carolina. Children at the Union Hills Orphanage were a little shocked at Santa Claus's appearance when he parachuted onto the orphanage grounds as part of the 9th Air Force's Operation Christmas. First of all, Santa radio commentator Frank Edwards forgot his beard. Then, as Edwards was distributing toys, he noticed the rather startling expression on the faces of the children. "I looked down," Edwards said, "and discovered to my dismay that my pants were around my knees." Okay.
So what do you think?
I think he wasn't taking his job very seriously.
Yeah, although, you know, sometimes, you know, it's not so...
Forgetting your beard? Come on. That's a real... That's signature hair.
Of course, the real Santa would never forget his beard because it's a permanent part.
He's just busy, so sometimes people have to be stand-in Santas for him.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. But this guy didn't do the greatest job.
No, but I'm sure the kids loved their gifts when they got them.
This is true. And nobody's perfect.
That's right. Except me. No, just kidding. So we'll do the last one.
Okay.
This story is dated December 26th of 1958, and its headline is "All 18 of them, ... Christmases have Merry Christmas." New Orleans, Louisiana. This is a United Press International story. It was a Merry Christmas for the Christmases, all 18 of them, in spite of all those wisecracking telephone calls. There were Josie, Eugene, Margaret, Lori, Rose, Sam, Earl, Louis, Winfield, and Joseph, but no Mary or even Mary. Josie says she was the only Christmas in town that she knew of until about 15 years ago. Then members of the Christmas family began migrating downriver from Natchez, Mississippi, and now they all get together for Christmas. Among them are housewives, soldiers, construction workers, meat packers, and a physiotherapist. As usual on Christmas Eve, the telephone at Josie's house jingled constantly while the Christmases were decorating their tree. The callers were anonymous, but the nature of the calls was familiar. Quote, "If you're Christmas, where's Santa Claus?" one caller asked. "Merry Christmas, ho, ho, ho," said another. And another, "Christmas? I thought you didn't arrive until the 25th. Are you here already?" The maker of that last call was informed cheerfully that the Christmases are around 365 days a year, or 366 in the leap years. So I did check, and it turns out, this is the beauty of the internet, there are 7,385 people with the last name of Christmas in the United States.
That's a lot.
And worldwide, there's only 14,370, which basically means half of them live within the United States.
They all live in the United States. Or half, yeah.
I've never met anyone with the last name of Christmas, honestly.
I have not either, no.
Yeah. Of course, we live nowhere near Mississippi. You were going to tell a little bit of a story.
Yeah, I just thought it was cute that people back then, you know, did prank phone calls because people don't do that anymore because most people don't have landlines. And when I was a kid, I remember staying over at a girlfriend's house and calling up just random phone numbers and asking people how many Campbell soups they had in their cupboard. And one time this one woman went and spoke to us for quite a few minutes about it. Then we hung up and laughed our heads off saying she didn't have a clue. And of course, we're like in fourth or fifth grade. So with our squeaky voices, she knew all along that it was just a prank phone call that we were making, you know, and people don't do that anymore. I think it's,
at least that we
lost
know of
art.
Yeah, now they send prank texts. I don't know. I really don't know what young kids do today.
Yeah,
I can't say I've ever done that in my life. Yeah, it never even occurred to me. Of course, as you know, I don't like picking up the phone, so it probably would never happen.
Well, there you go.
I won't even call for a pizza, as you know. So, Mary Jane, earlier in the podcast, I asked you when the first Christmas film was made, and I told you at least get to the right decade.
Decade, yeah.
So what were you thinking?
Well, we talked about, you said something that kind of like a hint that it's as far back as silent movies.
Oh, it's definitely a silent movie.
Okay, so I'm going to go pretty far back.
And how pretty far back is that?
I'm going to say, I feel like this is Let's Make a Deal. 1905?
You're close.
Okay.
You're off by just a little bit. It was made in September of 1898.
Yeah. You know, I was even thinking 1900, but yeah.
Because I know you're going to be
old. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you're going to be shocked by this, but it was titled Santa Claus. And it was a film made by a guy named George Albert Smith, who was an established portrait photographer at the time. The entire film ran, you ready for this? 1 minute and 16 seconds.
Right, yeah.
And it starred his wife, Laura Bailey, and their two children, who were Dorothy and Harold.
Can you see it online?
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, actually, what I'll do, of course, I'll show it to you by yourself, but I will put it up on my website.
Thank you, Steve. That'd be very nice.
No, you can never look at it, but I will put it up on my website. So if you go to uselessinformation.org, I will post that. If it's not there and you go to check, someone send me an email, but I will try and remember to post it there.
That'd be cute.
Yeah. Anyway, it's actually a cute, I think it's very well made for its time. Basically, there's a maid who puts two children asleep. Then she goes and she turns out the light, and then Santa suddenly appears and fills their stockings. And in an instant, he vanishes, which is presumed to go, he went up the chimney.
Right.
And it was quite advanced and ingenious for its time. It's the first known use of parallel action. The kids are in bed while Santa's up on the snowy roof of the house. So you have two kind of scenes going on at the same time. And, of course, it involved double exposure. So, as I said, I'll put this up on my website for everybody to take a look at. It is worth looking at. I actually enjoyed watching it.
Sure.
By the way, he did make another one I don't remember the exact title, but basically The Death of Mary Jane.
What?
Yeah. What? Yeah, it's not as good, but involves his wife also. I don't remember the exact
title.
You're joking. No, I'm not. But basically, she does something and she blows herself up, and then people come and are around her grave, and then her ghost comes out of the grave. So, but they're all very short. I mean, making films back then was A, very costly, very time consuming, and very complicated. So,
okay.
So we should bring this podcast to a close, and I'll just remind everyone that my latest book, The Flipside History, is currently available, as are my two previous books. Those are Einstein's Refrigerator and Lindbergh's Artificial Heart, and all three books are collections of long-forgotten true stories, just like the ones you always hear on this podcast. If you'd like to contact me about anything, whether it be regarding this episode, the podcast itself, my books, or whatever, my email is steve@uselessinformation.org. It's steve@uselessinformation.org. You can also contact me through my website, which is uselessinformation.org, or you can use Messenger on Facebook. Be sure to subscribe to the Useless Information Podcast through your favorite podcast platform so you'll have immediate access to new episodes when they're released. My Twitter feed is @UselessInfoCast, and be sure to like the show on Facebook. You can just do a quick search there, and the Useless Information Podcast should pop up. Anyway, I plan on being back in a couple of weeks with a new story. I should mention I'm having surgery on December 17th on my mouth, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk.
Could be a problem.
Yeah.
For a little while.
Yeah. I'm actually getting a series of four surgeries. They're all related to receding gums. I had a major one done about, 10 days ago now?
Yes.
And this is actually the first day I can kind of move my lower lip And speak, yeah.
I
could talk, but it hurt a lot. Yeah. But it's kind of receded at this point. And therefore I'm going under the knife once more. Anyway, so maybe I'll be back before the first of the year, and I'm not sure, maybe not. If I'm a little late, that's unfortunate, but that's what's going to happen. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening, and I wish everyone a happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays.
And take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Well, here we are at the end of our Christmas program. And as Elmer Burt would say, I sure hope you all have a very Merry Christmas. I hope. And I hope when you wake up Christmas morning, besides all the other stuff, maybe you'll find in your stocking a nice big can of that delicious Dole pineapple juice from Hawaii.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.